Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, December 2nd, 2019. Hope you had a great break for Thanksgiving. We did. A lot of wild weather here on the West Coast and across the United States. So I hope it didn't hamper your activities or leave you trapped somewhere, like at an airport. Well, I am astounded by the lead story I am selecting for today's News and Comment podcast. It's published today in the New York Times. The headline reads, Assange to testify on being recorded in embassy in London. Now, I think it's an important story, but it runs 3.5 pages when I printed it out on 8.5 by 11 paper. And not until you get to near the bottom of page 3 do you learn the critical facts here. And in journalism terms, that's called burying the lead. And in this case, the lead is buried to the point where the average reader would be completely unaware. So, the story is something that we have sketched for you before, that sometime in the past couple of years, before Julian Assange was ejected from the Embassy of Ecuador in London, where he had been granted asylum, the Ecuadorian authorities signed a contract with a Spanish surveillance company. They installed new video cameras, including cameras with microphones located in the bathrooms. And so Assange, suspecting that he was under constant surveillance, sometimes held meetings in the lavatories. And now recordings have surfaced that show that even when he ran the water and played the radio and did other things so he could try to have a conversation that wasn't picked up by the spooks, well, the spooks had better equipment and they were able to hear much of what he and his visitors were saying. But the stunning part of this story is who paid for the surveillance, and that's what the New York Times elected to bury on page 3 of my printout of this story. Because it turns out that Trump's biggest single donor, casino operative and extreme Zionist American, the owner of the Las Vegas Sands, Sheldon Adelson, paid for the Spanish company and its CEO travel to Las Vegas about twice a month with CDs and hard drives with that information. Now, this is another remarkable case where the Trump administration has used freelancers, volunteers, cronies who are intimate with the president to some extent, to do what would be the official business of the United States. Now, I don't support the CIA spying on Julian Assange at a foreign embassy in London. It violates a number of laws, standards, and it's in very poor taste. But the idea that Trump would outsource this because I guess he doesn't trust the deep state to do the work that it is intended to do, even if I don't approve of it. And so the way he hired Giuliani to run his Ukraine investigation, he reached out to Shelley Adelson, who said, sure, Mr. President, I don't care what it costs. I've got billions of dollars. And for the New York Times, they don't even mention Adelson in the headline or the subhead. They don't raise any issues about parallels to Ukraine. Why? Well, it appears I have to speculate here. But it appears that the editors of the New York Times approve of Trump engaging one of his biggest backers. I believe it's the single biggest donor to Trump's campaigns, and asking him to set up a surveillance system. And presumably that was shared with the CIA after it was received by Adelson. Now, this shows the lengths the United States will go to to try to rig the legal system. Who has control over these recordings? Will they be handed to prosecutors for what is expected to be the eventual trial of Julian Assange in an American court under the Espionage Act? This is a very dangerous precedent. And this coverage is beyond contempt. I've linked to it. I encourage you to read this and criticize it yourselves. It's written in a breezy style. Opens with this: when Julian Assange was living in Ecuador's embassy, someone was spying on him. The question is, who ordered their surveillance? And it's written like a little short story where they get to the answer late in the narrative. This is really bad journalism, and it's bad news, too. Meanwhile, over at Consortium News, they have published a letter signed by at least 61 intellectuals from 16 countries addressed to the Archbishop of Canterbury, respectfully calling on the moral authorities of the United Kingdom to use their influence to obtain immediately the release of Julian Assange, citizen of Australia, from Belmarsh Prison, where he is being unjustly and cruelly incarcerated. Assange is not charged with any crime or even misdemeanor in Britain and has fully served his sentence for a single offense, jumping bail to avoid extradition to the United States via Sweden. He was not and is not charged for any crime in Sweden. The sole charges against him originate in the United States on purely political grounds, aimed at punishing Assange for publication of accurate information provided by informed sources. It is quite clear in their current treatment of Assange, the United Kingdom is debasing itself as a mere instrument of political repression exercised by the United States. The current imprisonment of Assange is a blot on the nation's judicial system, a disgrace to British decency. This scandal may be largely hidden today, but will surely emerge in history unless measures are taken immediately by the highest representatives of the British people to correct this major injustice. And we ask you to respectfully transmit this message to Her Majesty, Queen Elizabeth II. Now back to the New York Times and its incredible reporting on Assange. Their Sunday single editorial is headlined, "Who Will Tell the Truth About the Press?" And the editors make a legitimate attack on Donald Trump for his repeated attacks on the media. 600 times he has tweeted out claims of fake news. Now, I deplore Trump in his, and they cite Hitler, how the Nazis came up with a phrase called Lügenpresse, which is translated as lying press. And unfortunately, this has similarities to the suppression of the media, the news organizations in Nazi Germany. But this editorial makes no comment about the failures of the corporate media led by the New York Times. By the way, they have reduced their standards because Trump, because Russia. They have declined in their standards of reporting. They use anonymous sources. They use documents that they haven't seen, that somebody read to them over the phone. They were doing it again just last week. And so, as the corporate media has debased itself and has used tabloid tactics against this despicable president, I cannot, you know, embrace this message from the New York Times until they engage in some sort of self-examination and acknowledge at least some of their failures. I won't hold my breath on that. So I do apologize to the people of London and Great Britain, because by the time this podcast is heard in London, Trump will have arrived. And we do apologize. He brings a stench with him. He's coming to stink up the NATO meetings. And as you know, I believe that NATO is adrift. We're seeing leaders like Macron of France and Merkel of Germany offer very divergent visions for the future of NATO. And I believe that it's just an extension of the U.S. military that we use at our convenience. It really has little resemblance to its original mission following World War II. So I don't expect much to come out of this except more fractured international relations, more bruising of American allies. They've already acknowledged that some of the countries are going to chip in more money, as Trump has been complaining about. But the challenge by Turkey, buying weapons from Russia, engaging in unapproved actions in Syria that have rankled members of NATO, there are serious issues, and I don't know if they will be actually confronted at this meeting. So on his way to Britain, Trump hit the Twitter box over and over again, and in one of them, he tweeted out new tariffs aimed at Brazil and Argentina. And he is imposing tariffs on steel and aluminum from those countries. And this just widens the trade war. Stock market was off by at least 1% today in reaction to this. And I will restate that I am not a free trader. But tariffs by tweet will not change the trade picture. It will hurt countries. It will hurt Americans. Last week, my friend Rick from Santa Barbara came up for a visit. He has been importing products since the 1970s, starting with calculators and airbeds. And he told me that Trump's tariffs are killing him. The additional 25%, he's been, doing fashion and handbags and things like that. And he said that he cannot compete. And he wanted to make very clear and ask me to share with my listeners that he is paying the tariffs. And he passes them along in the retail price to you, the American consumer. It is not China or anybody else that we have attacked with tariffs who is paying them. It is American consumers. Lori Wallach, who is an expert on international trade at Ralph Nader's Public Citizen. She's appeared on this podcast several times. She has a great piece that appeared in the New York Times, How to Fix the World Trade Organization. And this relates to the issues of the WTO and the way it's not just about trade, and how when they impose orders in cases that come before this international tribunal, they often impose regulations that kill domestic regulations. Out of 242 WTO cases, only 22 cases, did the domestic policies survive being challenged. So I hear a lot of people who get called conspiracy theorists. I don't tend to use that line. But people who fear one world government and Plan 2100 from the United Nations, well, I believe the WTO is much more of a threat because of its power over trade and the way most countries knuckle under to it. So under Obama, we stopped appointing people to the WTO, and it now suffers from a lack of a quorum. And as of December 11th, it will no longer be able to review these trade deals. Now, that's not all good because it leaves in place the damage that has been done, but it certainly does send a message. Now, Democrats are juggling impeachment and whether they are ready to approve Trump's NAFTA 2.0. It's renamed the U.S.-Mexico Trade Agreement, something like that. And Pelosi has it on her desk and will probably bring it for a vote shortly. There's still some complaints, but overall, corporate America and many labor organizations believe that it is an improvement. It requires a $16 minimum wage at auto plants in Mexico, and that could help avoid more job loss heading south of the border. So here's a quote from Lori Wallach. Unless Trump agrees to add stronger labor and environmental standards and enforcement and secures progress on labor reforms in Mexico, NAFTA job outsourcing will continue. And the big pharma giveaways that Trump added must go. They make this new agreement worse than NAFTA. Good article at The Intercept today under the byline of Rachel Cohen. She points out that as Pelosi gets ready to deliver a victory to Trump in passing the new trade law, there is an important bill for organized labor in this country that has been sitting on her desk for some time now. It's the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, the most comprehensive rewrite of U.S. labor law in decades. It would eliminate right-to-work laws. I call those right-to-work-for-less laws. Impose new penalties on employers who retaliate against organizing. Crack down on worker misclassification. And establish new rules so that employees cannot delay negotiating collective bargaining contracts. So it's got enough votes to pass in the House, but Pelosi has been sitting on it. So if you feel like blowing in a call to the Speaker's office, I think that is a worthwhile issue to address. Open letter written and published at The Guardian today with a number of people speaking up on behalf of democracy in Bolivia. We, the undersigned, call for Bolivia's democratic institution and processes to be respected. It's really an attack on the intervention of the Organization of American States, which joined forces with the United States in claiming that the October 20 election was rigged, and therefore they need a new one, and Morales is not the president of Bolivia anymore. The problem is that his term doesn't expire until January. And nobody argues about that, right? But he has been removed by a Catholic, right-wing, racist minority of wealthy people. And the coup is a coup, even if we don't call it that in U.S. media and political circles. So the letter says, we call upon the OAS to retract its misleading statements about the election, which have contributed to the political conflict, served as one of the most used justifications for the military coup. We ask the U.S. Congress to investigate this behavior of the OAS and to oppose the military coup. Is there a Democrat who will stand up and say that? Well, I hope so. I found more yellow journalism in Sunday's New York Times. A front-page article about hunger that is leading to students not going to school. And I believe that the reporting is accurate. I think there are problems because of the economy in Venezuela. And here's how the New York Times explains it. It is a major embarrassment for the self-proclaimed socialist government, which has long preached social inclusion. The situation is in sharp contrast to countries that Venezuelan leaders hold up as role models like Cuba and Russia. Students began skipping school in Venezuela shortly after President Nicolas Maduro came to power in 2013. A fall in the price of the country's main export, crude oil, combined with Maduro's ill-timed effort to double down on price and currency controls, sent the economy into a recession from which it has not yet emerged. Not a single word here about the United States-led sanctions that have led to, by independent reports, as many as 40,000 deaths in 2018 alone. Not a word. And Nicholas Kristof, as I mentioned a week ago in the New York Times, wrote a column where he did his obligatory denunciations of socialism and Maduro. But in between it all, he said, you know, I think American sanctions are causing people to die in Venezuela. But apparently the people who write these news stories don't read the opinion page, and so that's what we get. Every day I pause for a minute to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like the fine folks at DGL Engraving, Julie Dupree, Joe Clarici, Carl Howard. They each kick in $5 or $10 a month, and I invite you to do it too. I need your support to pay the bills and keep the operation going. So just drop by peterbcollins.com, click on menu, click on become a subscriber. You'll hit the sign up page and it's easy to choose a level of support that's comfortable for you. And I always like to give out my P.O. box in case you don't like PayPal and you want to send me a check or cash or money order, whatever you like, in the U.S. mail. American currency is preferred. My address is Box 150, 660, San Rafael, California. zip code 94915. By now, you know that Trump made a secret flight to Afghanistan to visit some American troops, and he also had a brief meeting with President Ashraf Ghani. But he surprised everybody, including the Taliban, by declaring that the Taliban is ready to declare a ceasefire. Now, it was Trump who killed the negotiations back in September, and even at that point, we didn't have the leverage to get the Taliban to agree to a complete ceasefire. And now Trump imagines he can concoct this out of thin air. The Taliban seems surprised by Mr. Trump's declaration, says the New York Times. While the group's negotiators have held informal meetings with U.S. diplomats in recent weeks about ways to go back to the table, on Friday their leaders said their original position on a ceasefire had not changed. Quoting a member of their negotiating team, "The Americans walked away from the table, and now the ball is on their side. It is up to them to come back if they want to solve this and get the document to signing and to the stage of implementation. Our positions remain the same." Meanwhile, the empire is reeling from another loss, a setback in Iraq, where the public protests and the rising death toll led Prime Minister Adel Abdul Mahdi to submit his resignation. It's been accepted by the parliament. The big problem is that Mahdi was a brokered compromise candidate. And trying to maintain this fragile coalition and appointing a new prime minister is not going to be easy. Parliament has approved that resignation without a vote. And it's going to be, I think, very fluid, if not volatile, in Iraq for the foreseeable future. Today, I'm releasing a fresh, in-depth interview podcast with Mike German. Many people know Mike as a former FBI special agent who has become a credible critic of the bureau he once worked for. He's got a new book out called Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide: How the New FBI Damages Democracy. And in this excerpt, you hear Mike German talk about the lack of credibility that St. Bob Mueller had even before he took on the Russiagate investigation.
But Mueller's history would not have given anyone, even pre-FBI history, would not have given anyone confidence that he was going to be the type who would upset the rowboat, right? You look back to his tenure at the Justice Department as head of the criminal division when the FBI was investigating the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI, mm-hmm. and the Banco Laverno.
Yeah.
And those investigations were uncovering significant money laundering by a host of different actors, including drug kingpins and corrupt governments all around the world, and yet the investigation was somewhat slow walk and hampered at the Justice Department in a way that caused not just Congress to complain about it, but when Robert Mueller was nominated to be FBI director, even the Wall Street Journal came out against him because of his handling of those cases while he was at the Justice Department.
That's former FBI agent. He's now a fellow at NYU's Brennan Center on the Law. That's at New York University. And his new book, as I mentioned, is a good critique of the FBI since 9/11. It's called Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide. And those are some of the tactics that will be used by Republicans as the impeachment inquiry moves from the Intelligence Committee, which is expected to vote out its report from the Ukraine interviews and testimony, public testimony, on Tuesday, which will then land at the Judiciary Committee, which is going to hold public hearings starting Wednesday. Now, Trump believes that he's being slighted here because the Democrats who are running all this know that he was going to go to London. This has been on the schedule for a while. And he's complaining that they intentionally did this so that he couldn't attend the meetings. And on Friday, I called bullshit on Trump's claim that he badly wanted to participate. He wanted to personally testify. It's never going to happen. That's just a fraudulent posturing on his part. But today, in announcing that his lawyers will also decline to operate or to participate in what they call an unfair process, the White House counsel Pat Cipollone turned down an offer from Chair Jerry Nadler of the Judiciary Committee for Trump or his lawyers to participate. And they do reserve the right to change course. And, of course, they could reserve the right to stop stonewalling and allow key witnesses like Rudy Giuliani or Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, to testify in public. So we'll be watching this process go forward. I believe that it is still useful to expose Trump's wrongdoing. And now that we know that he got Shelley Adelson to pay for the spying on Julian Assange, what other back channels or irregular channels has Trump set up? But we still have a problem that the Republicans are holding firm. And the Democrats seem convinced that they will limit the articles of impeachment to a couple focused on alleged abuse of power related to Ukraine, another on obstruction of congressional investigations, including the intelligence committees, and potentially an article on obstruction of justice from the Mueller investigation. And I keep saying, Michael Cohen pled guilty, said Trump directed him to commit a crime. Don't leave that one out, guys. Just don't do it. So the tactics of disruption of the next phase of the hearings have surfaced, and Kellyanne Conway, doing the president's bidding, is demanding that Adam Schiff testify. Now, they're claiming that he is a fact witness, and their alternative facts, which Kellyanne is famous for, relate to any contacts with the unnamed CIA whistleblower by Schiff and or his staff before the whistleblower actually submitted the letter of complaint. Now, that is an angle the Republicans have raised as part of their overall distraction campaign, but I'm sure that the Democrats will not fall for this gambit where they would put the chair of the Intelligence Committee on the stand to be peppered by questions from the Republicans. Rudy Giuliani is threatening a libel suit against Steve Hilton, who is an anchor on Fox News. That's because Steve Hilton called called for the president to dump Giuliani and calling him an unethical disaster. Now, Giuliani fired back on Twitter, "Lawyers tell me Steve Hilton is a wild card and I should sue him for libel. He recklessly disregarded the truth." Well, this is just silly stuff, because what this guy has said are his opinion. Giuliani is a public figure, and he cited the language of the law that you have to recklessly disregard the truth. Well, I don't think that nexus has been crossed. We have comments from the Ukrainian president, Zelensky. He said, "I never talked to Trump from the position of a quid pro quo. That's not my thing." This is an interview with Time magazine. "But you have to understand, we're at war. If you're our strategic partner, then you can't go blocking anything for us. I think that's just about fairness. It's not about a quid pro quo. It just goes without saying." So we're also hearing that the Trump campaign has issued notice to Bloomberg News that their reporters will not be given access and credentials for the Trump campaign. Now, so many Americans rely on Bloomberg News for their political coverage that I'm sure this is going to be a major setback. A couple of people have dropped out of the Democratic primary. Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, who I always thought was kind of channeling John Boehner on, Three Merlots, kind of talks too loud and says stupid stuff. Well, he's out of the race. "While there were many obstacles we could not have anticipated when entering this race, it has become clear that in this moment I won't be able to break through of this crowded field." And my buddy Joe Sestak, the former Democratic congressman from Pennsylvania, has recognized that he has gained no traction and he is dropping out. I think based on some of the weekend reporting that Kamala Harris, the junior senator from California, should return to her day job. She has no momentum going forward in the Democratic primary, and the sooner she recognizes that, the more face she will save. Well, Mr. Malarkey, that's Joe Biden. Have you seen his new campaign bus with the Malarkey Express on the side? Joe is really going to capture the super senior vote. I mean, just for reference, all right, I'm 66 years old. Nobody I know uses the word malarkey. You got to be over 75 or 80 to have that in your daily vocabulary. Anyway, The Guardian does a good job today of pointing out some of Joe's self-created malarkey. Because as he goes into Iowa and other upcoming primary or caucus states, he's promising to fix the student loan problem, but not to the extent that Warren and Sanders talk about. He wants to reduce it, not eliminate it. Well, as The Guardian points out, it was back in 2005 when the Republicans had a bill to tighten the bankruptcy law, and Joe Biden was one of 18 Democrats who deserted his own party to vote for this bill. Now, primarily, he did it because he's from Delaware, and MBNA, one of the biggest credit card issuers in the country, they wanted this bankruptcy bill to be written and passed. And this is like the crack law that Joe Biden authored and was so proud of at the time. And he has ultimately recognized that he helped pack the prisons with nonviolent offenders. When will the public catch up to the incredible baggage of Joe Biden? Interesting piece on the op-ed page of Sunday's New York Times. Conservative columnist Ross Douthat makes a case for Bernie Sanders. He talks about Kamala Harris, whose nosedive is now well known, that she was well-suited to accomplish the unification of the Democrats through her female minority professional class identities. And that's not happening. And so he says, take a look at Bernie Sanders. Like other candidates, Sanders' support has a demographic core. Just like Warren depends on very liberal professionals and Biden on older minorities, Bernie depends intensely on the young. But his polling shows an interesting better-than-you-expect pattern, given stereotypes about his support. He does better than you expect with minorities, despite having struggled with them in 2016, with moderate voters and 100,000-plus earners, despite being famously left-wing, and with young women, despite all the Bernie bro business. This pattern explains why, in early state polling, Sanders shows the most strength in very different environments, leading Warren everywhere in the latest 538 average, beating Biden in Iowa, challenging him in Nevada, matching Buttigieg, actually outpacing him in New Hampshire, and leading him easily in South Carolina and California. Okay, I'm not going to argue with that. Now, as we've heard, conservadems, from Pete Buttigieg to Amy Klobuchar to who is that guy, John Delaney? I think he's still running. They're the ones who poo-poo Medicare for all. Too expensive, too socialist, it'll never happen, all that stuff. Well, we are learning that health industry lobbyists have assisted state-level lawmakers in publishing op-eds and making comments against single-payer health care. They did it in Montana with State Representative Kathy Kelker and Senator Jen Gross. They did it in Ohio with Senator Steve Huffman. And The Intercept, this is the Washington Post. Jeff Stein has the byline here. They report that the industry is very busy trying to provide talking points to prevent the evils of Medicare for all. And finally today, the new mayor of Chicago had enough of police chief or superintendent Eddie Johnson. He's been on the job for about 3 years, was cruising to retirement at the end of this year. But on October 17th after midnight, the superintendent was found asleep in a parked SUV. Johnson admitted he'd been drinking before he dozed off in his car near his home. but he blamed the episode on medication. Well, today the mayor said, Johnson was intentionally dishonest with me and communicated a narrative replete with false statements regarding material aspects of the incident in the early morning hours of October 17. Had I known all the facts at the time, I would have relieved him of his duties as superintendent then and there. And without explaining, she said that she won't disclose details because they wouldn't be fair to Mr. Johnson's wife or children. Uh-oh. Well, I won't speculate any further. I'll leave that to you, and I will thank you for listening to today's News and Comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.